evening, Chicago. Welcome to the show. Tom Bevin with you, co-founder and president of Real Clear Politics here on WLS AM 890, as I am every Sunday night talking politics. We got a good one for you tonight. We are going to discuss Joe Biden's first 100 days. I think the official date is the 30th of April, but you might want to check me on that. But we had a whole bunch of new polls out this morning. ABC News, Washington Post, NBC News, Wall Street Journal, Fox News. And we will dissect the public's approval of Joe Biden's first 100 days. We will also talk about the other big news of the week, the Derek Chauvin verdict in Minneapolis in the trial of the killing of George Floyd and the subsequent shooting of Makia Bryant in Columbus, Ohio, and the media's coverage of both of those events. So we have a lot to chew on this evening. But we are going to start with A.B. Stoddard. She's associate editor for Real Clear Politics. She joins me now on the phone. A.B., great to have you as always.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Absolutely. So, A.B., it is Joe Biden's. We are now at the 100-day mark or darn close to it. And this is, you know, I don't know what's special about 100 days, but it has become the measuring stick for presidents, where we always seem to make a big deal out of an administration's first 100 days. And as you look at the polls, again, I mentioned we had a bunch out today. If you look at our Real Clear Politics average of Joe Biden's job approval rating, it is at 53.1% approve, 41.5% disapprove. Most of these polls show that Biden's, you know, doing about 10 points better than Trump at this point in his presidency, but also lower than Obama and everybody else dating all the way back to Gerald Ford. So, and again, pretty heavily split along partisan lines. Democrats think he's doing a great job, 90%+ of Democrats and anywhere from 9% to 12% of Republicans, and obviously independents are in the middle. So how would you assess Joe Biden's first 100 days? What kind of grade would you give him if you had to give him a grade?
Well, I think in terms of...
And you can't say incomplete, by the way.
Right. I think I'd give him a good strong B+ in terms of keeping these high approval ratings. I mean, it is a very polarized country, and we don't ever expect to see the kind of support that Barack Obama had in the way that we've become so paralyzed by our negative partisanship and the power of that to inform people's, you know, voting patterns and everything. It's just really, really hard to get out of that break. And so the idea that he has something above what he won with by the 100-day mark is really good. Actually, CBS News YouGov poll today has him at 58 job approval. So these are, in this country, hard to get. Barack Obama numbers, I can't see a Republican or Democrat getting that again in my lifetime, unless something wonderful happens. But mired as we are, it just seems too difficult. So if you look at his response to the pandemic and stabilizing the economy, his top two goals, you know, people are really pleased with his performance outside of his coalition. Then you look at immigration, and not only are, you know, Republicans and independents disappointed, but his own party is, right, because they want him to do everything, and they wanted it done yesterday. So I think that if you look at everything but immigration, and of course Democrats are upset about gun control as well, these are numbers that are just, you know, they were going to be hard to keep sticking by the 100-day mark. So I don't know that they will. I've said that before on your show because of the patterns we're used to seeing. But if you're Joe Biden, you've got to be happy with this.
Yeah, you mentioned coronavirus, so we're keeping a Real Clear Politics average of that as well. It's at 62.4, so, you know, a good 10 points higher. And that includes, again, about 30 to 33% of Republicans give him favorable marks for the way that he's handled the pandemic. Economy is 52.7 approve, so still a majority there. And you mentioned immigration, 39.1. It's by far his worst issue, topic, category in terms of his handling of the issue thus far. But AB, you know, we saw Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez say earlier this week that she was pleasantly surprised. She was expecting a much more conservative administration, and progressives seem pleased Now, I saw Chris Christie on one of the Sunday shows this morning saying that, you know, basically that Biden has governed as a left-wing president, a progressive president, and that when the coronavirus recedes as an issue and voters are left looking at all of his policy proposals on, you know, the Green New Deal or on infrastructure, that they will sour. That was Chris Christie's sort of theory of the case. What do you make of that? And what do you think of Biden's, has he shifted leftward? I mean, he certainly, again, the progressives seem happy thus far, 100 days in.
Right. So I think we have to distinguish between what he promises, what he prioritizes, what he speaks passionately about, what issues he tends to focus on in private meetings, and what we're going to see as, you know, the end results in terms of legislation. Is it possible to pass police reform? I don't think so. Is that going to break the hearts of the Democratic Party? Yes. He is going to disappoint them in the months to come. So the idea that we'll conclude that he governed as a left winger is still open to question, because we don't know what he's going to be able to do for them. What he has done so shrewdly is he and his team have kept them happy and have kept them in the barn. Bernie Sanders continuing to say nice things, AOC continuing to say nice things. And then when she says things like the infrastructure plan is too small, that only helps him with people in the center of the electorate, the median voter. So far, so good on that relationship. I don't know. Yes, he definitely says he plans to go big and bold and to go for broke. That is what he's saying. I don't know that he can do it. And I don't know that, you know, we'll look back and see that he did it. But he is, by making those promises, definitely shocking Republicans, but keeping the progressives happy, which is important because the divided party loses. And it's a very divided party on the Democratic side. I think Joe Biden, you're right. Once we get off of the focus on the pandemic, people will focus on other things. But the contrast to Trump, you know, the NBC Wall Street Journal reporting about their poll today used a quote from a North Carolina voter who said, "I like Joe Biden because I don't have to think about Joe Biden." So the idea, so he has really had this arc of arriving as the vaccines picked up, the economy stabilizes, right, and he's normal. And he doesn't make news, and he's no drama. And so I think his honeymoon is lasting for those two reasons, because he's handling the pandemic well and because people really, really needed a break from the chaos. But like I said, you know, to answer your first question, do I think that the honeymoon can last in a country this polarized? No.
We got just about a minute left, AB. So I'm curious, is there anything that Joe Biden's done in the first 100 days that has surprised you or has been different than what you expected from him? Or is this proceeding pretty much how you thought it would?
You know, I actually thought that they were so much more pulled together than I expected them to be. They were so good at mitigating political liabilities, keeping their adversaries quiet, doing the care and the feeding. I was so surprised at how well they did that in the general election campaign, in the transition, and then in January and February, that when the border blew up, I was surprised that they stepped on a rake like that, that they knew in December was going to happen. This, they absolutely knew this would happen. This is a self-inflicted wound. And so looking at the way that they've governed, I'm surprised they got themselves into such a hole on immigration. It was a mistake. They know it was a mistake, and it was entirely preventable.
All right. Well, and that's going to continue to be a thorn. I'm not sure how that is going to be turned around in the short term. I think it's going to continue to be an issue for the administration moving forward. But we will have to leave it there. A.B. Stoddard, Associate Editor for Real Clear Politics. A.B., always great to have you. Thanks for your time tonight.
Thanks so much, Tom.
All right. Going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll talk more about Biden's first 100 days, comparing it to Trump's first 100 days, and also a little bit about another president. Stick around. We'll be back with Steve Cortez right after this. And we are back, joined now on the phone by Steve Cortez. He is a former Trump campaign official, frequent guest of this program, and contributor to Real Clear Politics. Steve, thanks for joining me.
Hey, you bet, Tom.
Always great to have you. All right. So we just we're talking about Joe Biden's first 100 days. We've reached that magical mark. For whatever reason, we focus on 100 days. And I'm right. Just curious, Steve, as we look at what grade would you give the Biden administration thus far?
Well, probably won't surprise you that I give him a very low grade. I mean, but let me, with a caveat. So, I mean, no, I give him a D. I mean, I really think that what he came in and did immediately, particularly regarding the border, where he has the most control, where he had the most ability to act unilaterally, I think what he did is so destructive to this country, to our economic security, national security, public health, that that alone is deserving of an incredibly low grade. Now, I will say this, in a caveat, to try to be somewhat objective about it, that he has laid out an incredibly aggressive agenda right out of the gate. And if I were a supporter of his, if I believed in his platform and voted for it, I would be pleased that they are being that aggressive that soon. Now, he also has the luxury of having both houses of Congress. And what I mean by that, not just though that they just have D's behind their names, but that they are fully on board and fully disciplined in following his message and his agenda and willing to vote for it. You know, Trump did come in with Republican House and Senate, but he certainly did not have that kind of unanimity of purpose with, you know, Paul Ryan, for example, who was then Speaker of the House. So, you know, I will give Biden some sort of left-handed compliment of saying, OK, he is pursuing his agenda aggressively. He seems to have full buy-in from the Congress. He deserves a strong grade in terms of tactics on that score. But for just the welfare of our country, for our safety and prosperity, I give him a D. And again, almost exclusively because of what he's done at the border.
You know, you mentioned Trump, and I did want to talk to you, having been on the Trump campaign, you know, and him coming into office, you know, he really did. I mean, he was fighting basically the Democrats and part of the Republican Party and, right. you know, the media and, you know, parts of the established D.C. bureaucracy, i.e. the deep state, who were, you know, you remember the leaks of his phone calls with foreign leaders. I mean, it was just. Right. From the get-go, it was all-out war every single day, hand-to-hand combat. Right. And he still managed to get stuff done, which is, you know, looking back, fairly amazing. What do you remember about Trump's first 100 days and how that was different both in tone and tenor and media coverage from what we have now?
Right. Well, of course, you know, the media coverage was just complete polar opposite. And to put some actual data behind that, so it's not just my opinion, Media Research Center, which is admittedly a conservative group, but I think they do very legitimate studies when they try to filter out the percentages of coverage. And when they watch the traditional broadcast networks, ABC, NBC, CBS, in the first 3 months of coverage, so almost at 100 days, and they compared the two in terms of positivity versus negativity on network nightly news on a national basis, it was 89% negative in the first 3 months for Trump. It was 59% positive for Joe Biden. So, I mean, that right there shows you numerically just how drastically different the approach of corporate media has been. And look, I think those of us in the Trump campaign and in the America First movement more broadly, we knew that we were in for a battle, but I don't think, Tom, we knew just how disastrous and really reprehensible the tactics of the opposition would be, particularly when I say the opposition within the civil service of the United States. I don't think, at least I personally, was not quite ready, and I don't think the president was ready. President Trump was quite ready for how vicious and vile, and in some cases, in my view, illegal, the deep state, the permanent political class, administrative state was willing to act to stymie Donald Trump. Now, he still got an enormous amount done. He still wound down the disastrous wars of his predecessors in Iraq and Iran. He brought absolutely historic peace deals to the Middle East. He had a first-in-a-generation tax cut that we are still benefiting from today. So he got an enormous amount done, but you know, much was left undone that we were hoping to get done in a second term, you know, had we won. And it's now going to have to be done in a second term, whether it is for Trump or another America First Republican president that I believe we can elect in 2024.
So speaking of presidents and former presidents, I saw a tweet of yours. You're doing these chalk talks on Twitter, and you took issue with another former president, 43, because of he's back in the news this week. Tell our listeners a little bit about that.
Yeah, so George W. Bush has been all over the airwaves. They've probably seen him if you paid any attention to news over the last week. He's supposedly promoting a book of paintings and about immigrants. But in reality, what he's been doing is the corporate media has been fawning over him, and he's been completely maligning the America First movement generally and Trump specifically. Now, mind you, George W. Bush never spoke about Barack Obama. Never. He said he owed him his silence. He did not extend that same courtesy at all to Donald Trump, not when he was in office and not now. He appeared on the Today Show, where his daughter is a co-host, at least for the last hour of the show. I've been pointing out in some of my columns and tweets and so forth that, you know, it's fascinating. So he is very much part of the Bush dynasty, George W. Bush. His grandfather was Prescott Bush, a senator. Of course, his father was the president. His daughter, who's only in her 30s now, has a massive TV talk show role. Dynasties are great if you happen to be born in them. But for the rest of America, my point is the Bush dynasty has been horrifically bad, and specifically regarding W. Before he goes around throwing stones, you ought to take a look at his own glass house regarding his presidency. Two numbers to me really stand out that I put in my chalk talk today. And I try to harken back to my glory days of athletics 1,000 years ago. And that's where I got the idea of chalk talks, but they seem to resonate. But two numbers that I think folks should be aware of that I think are so damning of what W did to this country. The first one is during his tenure, we lost 4.6 million manufacturing jobs. That's according to St. Louis Fed data. And I think that's primarily because in 2001, he is the one who welcomed China into the World Trade Organization with open arms on terms that were incredibly beneficial to Beijing. And then the second number that I put in that chalk talk is the total U.S. war dead in Iraq, 4,424 Americans killed, precious American souls lost in a senseless, needless war that did not make this country one iota safer, in fact, may have made us less safe. That is the real legacy of George W. Bush. So the media loves him now. Remember, they hated him when he was in office. He was a racist, just like every Republican office holder when he was in office. They now adore him only because he can't stand Trump. But let's remember who W. really is and what his legacy truly is for this country.
We got just a couple minutes left, Steve, and that sort of begs the question about the state of the Republican Party and the split that's gone on or is going on or continues between sort of the old Republican Party, the one that was, you know, free trade at all costs, intervention abroad, and the sort of new Republican Party, which is the sort of which Trump sort of cast in his own image of America first, national populism, bring right. the troop home, you know, manufacture things at home, all of that. Where do you think that division stands right now? If you had to put a percentage on it, what percentage of the Republican Party do you think is the new Republican Party, and what percentage of the party is still the old Republican Party that is the folks who still like George W. Bush or like that right. kind of Republicanism?
Listen, you know, in terms of the voters, and I think this is key because, of course, media focuses so much on media and on elected officials. OK, within that crowd, within the sort of cognoscenti of the Beltway, you know, it's probably 60-40 toward the old. Right. In terms of Republican voters, though, across America, I think we are in the 80s to 90s percentage of America First, a populist nationalist party. And to give you some evidence backing that, for example, right now in America, a poll just taken by Pew, 72% of Republican voters still do not believe that Joe Biden won the election legitimately. Now, that is a massive percentage of Republicans. That tells me that certainly, in all likelihood, all 72% of them are populist nationalists, and perhaps an additional percentage who may have thought that Joe Biden won legitimately, but still subscribe to the America First agenda and program exists. So the Republican Party, as far as the voters go, has been fully transformed. But I'll be the first to admit, as far as the power brokers, elected officials, big donors, the Mitch McConnells of the world, the Kochs, those sorts of crowds, absolutely. The battle still sort of rages there. But that's a legacy issue that you would expect when a party transforms as drastically as the Republican Party has over the last 5 years. But I firmly believe the future of the party is in populist nationalism, is in the America First agenda, whether it is Trump or not. Again, that movement preceded him with the Tea Party. It will certainly go on after him. He was instrumental in making it ascendant, but it's not just about Trump. It's bigger than that.
All right. We will leave it there. Steve Cortez, former Trump campaign official, contributor to Real Clear Politics. Steve, thanks for joining me tonight. Always great to talk to you.
You bet. Thanks, Tom.
All right. Going to take another quick break. We will be right back after these words. And we're back. Tom Bevin with you, co-founder and president of Real Clear Politics. Got John Cass on the line, the columnist extraordinaire for the Chicago Tribune. Mr. Cass, how are you?
Hello, Tom. Great to be here. Hello, everybody. I'm WLS. Listen to WLS.
Always great to have you, John. So let's talk about the big news this week, which was the Derek Chauvin trial. And effectively, he was convicted on all three counts, second degree murder, third-degree murder, first-degree manslaughter. He will be sentenced in a couple of weeks. And in the coming weeks, I should say, and we don't know exactly what his sentence will be. But obviously, there are plenty of folks that are pushing for him to serve the maximum amount of time in prison. John, what was your reaction to the verdict? You wrote a column about this, I think, this week, talking about the aftermath of the case. But what was your reaction to the actual verdict itself?
I think it was relief. Like most Americans, I want to be honest with it. You know, when I first saw the video of him kneeling on George Floyd's neck, I called it murder because it was just that weird kind of half grin on his face where people were telling him to get off the neck, you know. That really got me. But then, of course, you had the whole year, summer, of violence with looting and rioting. Oh, I'm not supposed to call it rioting, the Associated Press tells me. so I'll call it mostly peaceful, but quite violent protests as well. And I don't think any of that was lost on the jury or the people, the American people. They understood. If he walked, you're going to see violence. I don't think there's any doubt about it.
Yeah, I mean, it's very hard. I mean, I was a juror once in one. It was a civil case. And so I've actually been, you know, on the inside of a jury room.
Me too.
It's a fascinating experiment in sociology and psychology as, you know, dealing with your fellow jurors and even on a tiny little civil case like I was on, let alone, you know, the biggest trial in the history of policing in America. So they were under extraordinary pressure. I'm sure they were all very sensitive to, as you say, the consequences of their actions and decisions. But I think they reached the right decision, in my opinion. I think that, maybe the second degree murder charge. I know some people, I'm not a legal expert, but nobody's getting it. I hadn't seen anybody willing to defend Derek Chauvin and what he did. And so there was, it seemed like a collective sigh of relief. But do you think, John, that, you know, we saw the same day, we saw attention turn to this shooting in Columbus, Ohio with Makia Bryant.
Yes.
And it was immediately as if we were sort of back on the treadmill, not even getting a 2-second break. And we were back on the same treadmill, going around and around, jumping to conclusions about circumstances and whatnot. That was disheartening to me.
It was disheartening because it clearly shows, that the newsrooms of America are woke and have agendas. And there was precious little initial reporting that the Michael Bryant, who was shot to death, had a knife and was lunging at a victim who was lying on her back. So, you know, many of the headlines left out that fact, and it seems like it was safe for headline writers to write something that was overtly political, and that speaks to the woke newsrooms. But then an odd thing happened, and I'm sure you saw it, and many have written about it. I wrote about it in my Sunday column. The left began to immediately go full Blanche DuBois on this story. They created a fantasy in which, you know, like, let the kids fight with knives. Why are the cops involved? And you saw that reflected in tweets by Valerie Jarrett and by many of the political actors, Joy Reid and Bree Newsom and others. I think even the ACLU of Ohio. There were many, many, many examples of this. And I find it to be, it tells me that, you know, they had a narrative. And the narrative was Chauvin murdered Floyd. which I agree with the verdict, but also that white cops are targeting black people and it's all racism. And then you have this other case in Ohio, in Columbus, with Mikaia Bryant. And that was a completely different deal. But they had to create, they saw their narrative kind of bleeding out. And so they created a new narrative, which is let the kids have their knife fights. I mean, it's pathetic. And it tells me that narrative is everything. And, you know, facts don't really mean much to political actors.
You know, it did seem, John, unlike, I mean, we've talked about this before, right? You look at like the case of Adam Toledo here in Chicago.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's, you've got these cops, it's 2:30 in the morning. They're chasing people down a dark alley. It's a split second thing. The kid dropped his gun, turns, you know, so this was not that. She had a knife. It was clear. It was in her hand. She was moving to stab this woman. And but for the cop using force at that moment, you know, somebody else would be dead, some innocent victim. And
the headline would be white cop stands by as black child is killed. And remember, right, just a few days, maybe a day before, a 13-year-old girl was allegedly murdered in a knife fight. Between 2:13, not a knife fight, she was stabbed to death, allegedly, by another 13-year-old girl. So it seems like people on the left have lost their minds. They're desperate to continue the George Floyd narrative, and they're upset that anything might come, you know, deflect that. I'm being accused of being a right-wing, I don't know, old white guy, but it's just the facts are the facts. Every one of these situations is different. Adam Toledo, Mikaia Bryant, George Floyd, John Reyna. John Reyna is the guy I wrote about years ago. Old white man shot down by beanbag rounds in the guts, I think 5 or 6 times, and he bled out. And I think Real Clear Politics carried some of those columns.
I remember that, yeah. Absolutely.
And that was, he was an old white guy shot by a black cop. And I didn't accuse the black cop of being racist. But if the victim had been a Tuskegee Airman and the cop was not black, but, say, Freckleface and Irish, you would have a different, you know. Media would be
a national outcry.
Yeah. And I think the left is desperate to perpetuate, to play the race card, because that's what they have to organize voters for the midterms. And it plays out with Joe Biden racializing the Floyd verdict and then, you know, poisoning baseball, talking about Jim Crow 2.0. The whole thing is sad, you know?
Yeah. Well, they've certainly sort of tied themselves in knots, particularly in this last case. But we've got to leave it there. John Cass, columnist for the Chicago Tribune. John, always great to have you. Come back again.
Thank you, Tom Bevin. And hello, everybody on WLS listening to Tom Bevin. Thanks.
All right. We're going to take a quick break. We will be right back with more after these words. And we are back. Tom Bevin with you, co-founder and president of Real Clear Politics here on WLS AM. Joined now by Professor Charles Lipson of the University of Chicago. Professor, always great to speak with you.
It's great to talk to you, Tom.
So, Professor, you wrote for The Spectator earlier this week about the the title of the piece was Distorting the News to Inflame the Mob. And I guess my question for you is, how do you think the media has behaved in not only leading up to and in the aftermath of the Derek Chauvin verdict in Minneapolis, but in the, the Mikaia Bryant and other cases, even Adam Toledo here in the Chicago area, in handling all of the issues around policing and race and the use of deadly force, et cetera?
I think the media has been atrocious. And by that, I mean really two things. One is they have distorted specific events. The worst case was NBC News taking the video of the woman who was stabbing another woman, and the police coming in. They released the video camera from the police. They released the audio recording, and the stabbing is taking place. The policeman is yelling for everybody to stop, get on the ground. Nothing happens except that the woman continues to try to stab, and she's about to kill the other woman. The policeman shoots four times, and that's the event. And then they try to resuscitate her unsuccessfully. And all that's on camera. So we have the call. We have the video. What does NBC do? NBC edits the 911 call to exclude the fact that the woman who's calling in panic is saying they're trying to stab us. So there's a lethal threat. Then NBC, which has not only omitted that, this is the lead story or the second lead story of the day. So this is not being edited by a summer intern, right? And then NBC edits the video to remove the knife from the hand of the woman who is stabbing. So they have deliberately distorted the news. This is not an omission. This is a deliberate distortion. And the effect is to say there was no lethal threat here, that a policeman was intervening in. He knew there was a lethal threat. In fact, before he came in and he tried to get it to stop without shooting, she didn't. And he stopped a lethal threat only with bullets. And NBC completely distorted that.
Okay, so the question, Professor, is why? Why would they do that? What would motivate them as a news organization to make those decisions, those editorial decisions? And again, there were a couple other organizations that did something similar, but CBS and some others actually included the That's lethal great. Threat. So they why did. What was NBC thinking? Why do you think they did this?
Well, I think that a couple of things are happening. The first is that every issue is now about race. That's the number one issue. And every issue, and by race, I mean white privilege. But related to that, it's also that police are racist and they're systemically racist. And we've heard that out of the Biden White House. We've heard it from their press spokesman. It's clearly their official position. And in fact, in the aftermath of the Chauvin verdict, they're going to go in and do a systematic investigation of the Minneapolis Police Department. So race is everything. And then the and police bad. That's everything. And so I think they begin with the idea that police are not there to keep order or behave almost always in a responsible way, but rather are there to oppress people. And we've actually heard Democratic representatives not speak with sympathy about the woman who could well have been killed with this stabbing. They've only attacked the police and said he should have shot in the foot, or, you know, I mean, in other words, these are just ignorant people who don't know how policing works.
You know, I saw a story that was headlined. It was actually an AP story, and so it ran everywhere. But I found it on the Huffington Post, which is admittedly a liberal site. But it struck me because the title that they put on this piece was "Cops Killed Six People in 24 Hours After Chauvin Verdict." Right. And that is, again, that is the Huffington Post, but the AP title was, you know, hardly different. It says one verdict, then six police killings across America in 24 hours. And, you know, this to me is an example of how the media distorts, sensationalizes, strips all sorts of context from each of these individual instances, which all have their own set of unique circumstances that and basically sort of serve it up as if the police just went on a shooting spree because of the Chauvin verdict, which is absurd.
Now, mind you, what you're talking about is hard news. You're not talking about opinions. I'm giving you my opinion, right?
Correct.
Now. This is an opinion that I'm giving you. I don't write news stories. I sometimes have hard news in my stories, and I hope I don't distort it. But this is a news organization. And the other, and of course, the immediate effect of this, of course, is to ensure that people won't sign up to become policemen. It's hard already to recruit them. It's going to get harder. The pay is not all that great. Everything they do is subject. I mean, look, if they have a shooting, and of course, we give them a lot of power, and so we have to hold them accountable. They can't just go around beating things. But any reasonable look at the trajectory of American policing would say that it's much more controlled today than it was 20, 30, 40 years ago. It's much less racially biased, if biased at all. And so I find, and there's a secondary effect that people aren't looking at, but which has been studied. And that is when you put all these restraints on police, the obvious effect is that police don't get out of their cars. They don't shoot very much. And the effect of that is that there's a lot more street crime. Estimated to be 1,000 more people or so killed and 34,000 more felonies after the Justice Department goes into, I think it was 5 or 6 cities under Obama, and what Merrick Garland is going to do in Minneapolis, where they go in and review the whole department. Well, what do people do under those circumstances? They put their head down. They don't do affirmative actions which would restrain violent criminals. And I think that it's a more dangerous country out there as a result.
Well, I just, you know, as someone who entered the media business and now takes a look at and we really do try to present both sides to the story. We try to present the facts as they we see them and as they are. You know, I'm increasingly disappointed in the media and seeing them and I guess us as a result, guilt by association as part of the problem.
Do you think any journalism do you think that Medill or all the journalism programs, Missouri, Columbia, and so forth, are taking this as one of their prime problems to make sure that the people they're training understand that there's very diminished public trust, that there's been a blurring of the line between opinion and hard news, that there's a perception of bias? Do you think that they are emphasizing that?
No, I couldn't agree more. All right, we got to leave it there. Charles Lipson, professor of political science at the University of Chicago. Always great to speak with you.
My pleasure. My pleasure.
All right. And that's going to do it for me, Tom Bevin, co-founder and president of Real Clear Politics. We'll see you back here in 7 short days. Have a great week, everybody. Good night.